Our conversation today is going to be about alternative fees and the pricing mechanisms used in the legal profession. And you are the litigation program manager at Tyco, and with you today are two other people. And if you don't mind, please introduce them.
Sure. Ed, we're kind of taking a unique approach to this interview in that my role is litigation program manager, not an attorney. I formerly worked at DuPont for almost 13 years, and really we're looking at how to bring in best business practices to the practice of law. And with me are Joyce Chung, who is a summer intern who comes from the McIntyre School of Commerce, and also Tracy Katigbeck, who is the office manager for the corporate law department. So each of us, I think, brings in this business management aspect, and what I like to sometimes say is, what I provide to the Tyco Law Department is information management, business management, as well as relationship management skills. And I think that's part of my learnings of my tenure there at DuPont was there are other pieces to running a Tyco or running a law department other than just the legal advice aspect of this.
So you're suggesting then, if I'm interpreting correctly, that there's a business aspect to the delivery of legal services as well as the professional aspect.
That's exactly right. I think what we're really looking at is to run the law department as a business. And to, yes, there's indeed a bottom line. And in addition to just being managing costs, we're also looking at how the law department helps develop business. I think also to reduce risk and also to support the values of the company, including diversity. So this is, I think, the way we're looking at this, is how to match up the law department as really, as I say, running a business.
Well, you touch on a very sensitive subject, at least among lawyers, who for a number of years debate the issue as to whether law is a profession or law is a business. And I sort of walked away from that argument by saying it's a profession, but it has to be run in a business-like way. And I think you are bringing us back to that discussion by saying it's really a business. Am I interpreting you correctly?
Yeah, I think there's a marriage here, and sometimes it can be a shaky marriage to bring those who, I guess, bring the skills like Joyce and Tracy and myself, along with those who came from the law school to practice law. And I think in a corporate law department, having those brought together can really bring success. And we're very much answerable to via the board of directors here at Tyco. A lot of it is going to be those bottom line, those business results. And I think we're best to probably be able to provide that kind of reporting mechanism, but also to do things that allow us to be in that successful position to report those results. So I think it is something which, you know, we're not trying to turn lawyers into accountants. It's more what can we bring to go ahead and to support the lawyers who are working in the law department so they really are running, as I say, so we can generate business results.
Well, in today's world, the preeminent method of billing, or as one said, pricing, is based on the hour. And lawyers for many, many years have been using this method, though not forever. And how did we get to the point today where we are in terms of the methodology of pricing our services?
I think it's convenient, and as far as the hourly billing, it's convenient, it's the one that's been established, and I see a lot of tradition in legal services. And for all intents and purposes, maybe it's been successful. If law firms are making money, and law firm economics sometimes, I start scratching my head, but if it works, why go ahead and change it? What we're starting to see, though, I think, is the pressure on the corporations to go ahead and reduce those costs, so when they're reporting again their business results internally, this is going to be one of the issues, how to bring down the costs, how to bring down the costs. So I think this is what's starting to challenge more and more the hourly billing model, is going to be the pressure from the corporations to say this is just not necessarily acceptable just to pay for hours and not necessarily pay for results. So I think that's how we've gotten to where we are, and that's why I think with pressure being put on the law firms, along with some understanding that it is not just simply a squeeze play to simply go ahead and squeeze them out of any profitability, but to allow still for profitability, but for them to manage more their economics so they can be successful profit-wise, but also be able to deliver to the client what our greatest needs are.
Well, I know in recent times there's been a lot of discussion about alternative fee methodologies, and that comes from some dissatisfaction with the current methodology that we're using. But let me ask you the question this way. Is there anything right with the system today?
I would say what works right is that, again, it's something that's accepted, and therefore it's a very easy way to support the billing process. In other words, when a bill is presented and it's an hourly bill, and let's even say it has assigned task codes to it using the UTMF system, it's a way that a form of communication. It allows you to go ahead and the law firm to say, here's where we're billing. In addition to billing, this is where communicating to you where we put our work and how much time has been assigned. So it does create a certain structure that I think is one that you can track. And if you look at even creating budgets based on task codes and then hours that are put on the task codes, again, it gives you some measurement to kind of see if it's successful and if you're paying the right level for those services. So in that way, I think it can be good. So, yeah, I would say that there is some redeeming value to this.
Well, when you say there's some redeeming value, obviously there's something wrong with the system as well from your perspective. And I want to ask you then, if it's inequitable, at least from the corporate side, why is it that we're still using it? Why is it that so many corporate counsel still prefer what I would call this old way of doing business?
Yeah, I'll give my answer to this one of the issues and see if Joyce or Tracy has anything to add to this. But my feeling is that it's been, the acceptable practice to do it, and there's also this concern about risk and being able to take some risk. And the law firms might say, we're not going to do alternative fee arrangements because we don't have the data to support if we do it in a different way. And most of the alternative fee arrangements usually fall in the category of like a fixed fee. And what I also like to say is the fixed fee, sometimes the law firm feels like they're really getting fixed in a fixed fee. So I think there's a concern about taking that risk on their side, and the client is really presenting the case that they want cost certainty. Sure, that's something we value, but also are they allowing for any upside on that kind of fee arrangement, which is an incentive for the firms to do it. So I think there's this lack of confidence and trust that has kind of hampered the use of these alternative fee arrangements. And there's been enough discussion, as you mentioned already, Ed, for years, alternative fee arrangements, alternative fee arrangements. And what I found fascinating was, even in my prior tenure at DuPont, it wasn't always just the law firms not presenting AFAs that had been the blockade. It may have been that there was resistance by the in-house and that they thought, wait a second, with this kind of fixed fee or alternative fee arrangement, maybe I'm paying too much. What if I was able to get a result quicker and less like that, and therefore I'm not doing my job as a business manager? And what they weren't seeing, though, is that the result was something that would save us greater money in the long run, so we wouldn't have to pay a settlement at a larger rate. But what they were focusing on was just what they were spending on the fees and expenses. So I think there still is this lack of understanding and also, I'll say, trust and confidence. And I don't know, Tracy or Joyce, if you wanted to add anything to that.
Well, I think part of the hesitancy of in-house counsel using fixed fees or AFAs is also the fact that it, in some cases, forces them to work a little bit harder in managing a matter because the law firm is not going to be doing as much for a fixed fee. They negotiate the fee as they go along, so it's up to the in-house counsel to manage that matter a little bit more closely than they normally would have under the traditional hourly model.
Yep. So it takes a little bit more management actually on both sides, which probably requires more communication and more trust. Is that what you're saying?
I think it is. There's definitely more input by the in-house counsel with AFAs, where AFAs are involved, whereas before, in the traditional model, law firms throw whatever resources they have to a matter, be that attorneys, paralegals, and other resources. To get the job done. Now they're having to husband their resources so they do keep their profit. So that may mean for in-house counsel that they're spending more time in communicating with the outside counsel and also managing the matter.
And one of the things that you if didn't say directly, Jim, you intimated, and that is the fear, I think, on the part of outside counsel that there is the squeeze play going, and all the corporate counsel is seeking to do by having an AFA or alternative fee arrangement is to reduce the cost to the corporate client, and the way to reduce the cost to the corporate client is to reduce the profit to the law firm. How do we get over this?
Yeah, I think there's this variation of theme that can be done, which is how to go ahead and meet both needs, which is reduce total cost to the client, but also to even increase revenue or profitability by law firms. And I know that's an area that we tried to look at DuPont before I came to Tyco to say there is a way of doing this so that the firms are forced a little bit more to manage their own resources, but they start off with the question really to the client to say, what's the end game here? What would be a successful result? And then you can decide on what is the right level of treatment. And this goes hand in hand with, I think, an early case assessment process by which you say, this is what we think the case is valued at. And now we come up with a budget, which would say if we were to expend so much on this, and then you look at what is a good result, and you put it down, and you might even do a decision tree on this. I think going through that analysis, especially doing it with an in-house client, I'm very careful when I say in-house client, I mean the business person for the corporation, gives a greater comfort about what is the strategy. And then also greater comfort level about what we're spending, maybe investing, and what we are going to get as far as return on that investment. So I think with getting that information, I think the law firms have a little bit better feeling that this isn't just simply, they're just putting a budget up there for fees and expenses, but there's also this added part about it, which is so important as to what the result is, and that we value that. And based on such and such a result, we will pay a bonus assigned to that. So I think a lot of this is to shift the thinking from just the fees and expenses to really what is the outcome of the case. And those obviously can sometimes far exceed what you spend as far as just on the fees and expenses.
Well, you have included in a short answer probably a year's worth of material. And let me pick up on one aspect of what you said, because I think it's a novel way of looking at legal services. If I understood you correctly, you talked about ROI or return on investment, and I suspect from my own corporate background that what you're saying is that when a corporation spends X dollars, they want to know what return they're going to get for those dollars. It's not just an expenditure, but everything that they spend is really an investment. And I think ROI is a term that just doesn't play in the legal field, or at least in the minds of lawyers to date. And this whole discussion really is in part forcing the lawyer to refocus their thinking in terms of ROI for the corporate client. Am I correct?
That's exactly right. I'm finding that a few of the innovative law firms are starting to throw out that ROI term as well. For us, it really is when we want to display metrics to senior management, not just in the law department, I'm really talking outside the law department, I feel there's five or six key metrics that we want to show. Do we want to show what our spending is on outside fees and expenses? Sure. Do we also want to show what our total legal costs were? So you include settlements and payouts. Yes, we want to show that. We also want to show what our risk levels are. So when we value a case, we give it a tier level, 1 through 5. We want to show that. We also want to show what the cycle time of our cases is. And then the last one I was going to put in there was the number of cases. So if you look at those, you're really creating charts that have lines there. And what we're looking to do is to demonstrate that we're bringing down each of those. Because the concern would be, great, we do the capping off on the fees and expenses, but then all of a sudden we're paying more on the settlements and the payouts. And we want to be able to show, no, we're shifting everything that I just mentioned to a downward turn.
That's fascinating, and perhaps we have gotten ahead of ourselves. So let me pick this up, Jim, if I may, by asking you the following question. We're talking about AFAs, but what are the alternatives? What are alternative fee arrangements that are currently available to the hourly billing rate that you're either using or seeing and contemplating?
Yeah, what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to let Tracy start off with the answer to that, because she has just recently interviewed a number of our attorneys within the corporate law department at Tyco. So, Tracy, tell us what you've been finding.
Some of what came out of our interviews were the types of AFAs that we're currently using in the corporate law department, and those tend to be discounts, flat rates with a holdback, or a straight holdback. Some other alternative fees are blended rates, which we're not seeing very much of. Those tend to be the ones that we use here at Tyco, as opposed to the traditional model of hourly rates.
And when you talk about holdbacks, Tracy, what are you talking? How does that work?
A holdback would be a percentage of the invoice held back on a monthly basis.
For what purpose?
It's incentive for the firm to do a good job. It's tied in with bonus.
You're not suggesting that if I bill you $1,000, you're going to pay me $800, and because of that, I'm going to have an incentive to do the job better in order to get what I should have gotten in the first place?
Yeah, I think what the incentive is that the potential, and I think this is very much can be identified with what Jeff Carr has done at FMC, is that it's a 20% holdback on the monthly invoice, but with the potential of recouping that plus more. So in other words, if it was 20% held back, the law firm could recoup as a payout of that from 0 to 200% of that. So I think that's where we see where the incentive piece gets in there, is what the potential is.
Okay. So in other words, it is possible that the law firm could get not just the 20% back, but they could get 40% or two times
that
20%.
Right. That's exactly right. And the one thing which I just wanted Tracy maybe to go over, and if you're okay with this, is right now we do have a performance evaluation program for those holdbacks and a scoring system. And there's really six or seven areas that for the most part will sound pretty much as like subjective kind of analysis. But Tracy, just if you could just go over those with us.
Currently what we have in place here at Tyco is an evaluation of the firms. And they're done on a rolling basis depending on the matter. But there are certain key areas that we evaluate our outside counsel on, and this all contributes to that 0 to 200% that they could receive. Some of the key areas are how well they listen to the customer being Tyco. Another is their creativity. How do they approach possible, you know, stumbling blocks in a matter? Another criteria is where do they add value? Did they manage expenses compared to business objectives? Did they communicate expenses in a timely manner? Another is innovation. How well do they use technology? Do they use technology? And what kind of technology do they use? Another is teamwork. How well do they work with us, the client? How well do they work as a team within their firm? Are they putting the best resources available on our case? Those are some of the criteria that we use to evaluate our firms, our outside counsel.
Jim, let me ask you this question with respect to the criteria. It sounds to me like those criteria can be addressed by large law firms. Does that mean that Tyco or companies in your similar situation are prone to use large law firms and not small boutiques or sole practitioners or small firms in general?
We've actually got a mix right now, Ed, and we thought that the same kind of criteria can actually be used for some of the medium and smaller size firms. What I think is interesting is that those smaller, medium-sized firms are probably trying to differentiate themselves more in the marketplace. So to be able to have this kind of analysis and these type of metrics and be able to use that, one of my key phrases I like to use is to say how to turn metrics into marketing. And that's why I say where some of those innovative smaller, medium-sized firms can use this kind of feedback and to use it from a metrics view to really help with the marketing. So we actually have a mix, and we use this actually for all different levels of firms.
Well, I know you and I spoke earlier about the Six Sigma and how Tyco is using it. Why don't you explain what it is from your perception and how it is that you're using it in this particular arena?
Six Sigma is a methodology that was actually started at Motorola in the late 1980s and probably got more prominence with the use by General Electric. It's a quality improvement methodology in which you look to identify defects and variations to a process. So ultimately what you're trying to do is improve processes. What makes it different from other quality improvement programs in the past is the statistical analysis that's done to basically prove that you've improved a process. Now that improvement can lead to cost savings, it could lead to greater revenue, it could lead to reduction in risk. So there's a couple. I think classically it's been more on the how to reduce costs. Now most of these processes started in the manufacturing side, and now they're moving more into transactional services such as legal, human resources, finance at all. So Tyco began the use of Six Sigma, I think, almost 2 years ago. And again, just like with the other models, it started more in the manufacturing. And in January this year, about the same time that I started at Tyco, was really when it started to move into the transactional side. So what we've looked at is processes that we thought were either broken down or ones that needed to really show that, yeah, we maybe we're doing some good things in this area and we need to validate those good things and have the statistical analysis. And that could include things like even the reduction of law firms. And you listen to what they call the voice of the customer when you do a Six Sigma project. So the voice of the customer said, you've got too many law firms that you've got representing you on these matters. So we would take that analysis and start with that charge and statistically show why having too many law firms was adding to too much cost into what we're paying for fees and expenses and the like. We've also now done this, and Tracy is what's known as a green belt. And there's a couple different levels of leaders for projects. And Tracy has taken on projects which has to do with the utilization of alternative fee arrangements. So there's two things that we were trying to prove here. One was that alternative fee arrangements are a good thing. And the second thing was, if they're a good thing, how can we make them even better? How can we go ahead and have greater penetration in the type of arrangements we have right now so there's greater use of alternative fee arrangements? So what I kind of tasked Tracy, and Joyce has worked with her on this project, is to come up with what our baseline is currently with percentage of billings and also with percentage of matters that are working alternative fee arrangements. And then let's go ahead and move to a level which we will call Six Sigma, which is that we've got a greater ratio of arrangements that are on alternative fee arrangements, and move it up to something that close to maybe 80% or 85% of what we have billed to us is on an alternative fee arrangement. So I hope that explains what a little bit about Six Sigma is and how we've applied it, and especially about the alternative fee arrangements. And from what I know, we're probably one of the very few companies that has actually applied Six Sigma to the area of alternative fee arrangements. And one last thing I'd like to mention is that Tracy, in addition to interviewing in-house counsel, she's also going to interview outside counsel and what their viewpoints are, and she's got a series of interviews as part of the data collection process. So we can really see when we say what is good, and we're really looking to make sure these are successful for all parties.
You talked about a percentage, 80-85% of your arrangements being with the alternative fee arrangement rather than hourly billing. What's magical about that number?
Nothing. It was what I just came up with, and it's something I want to go ahead and get us on major radar screens. It shows that we were able to measure effectively where our starting point was, and we want to have some goal in mind there. I'm not sure if that's the number we're going to come out with, but I think we can. And the reason why I say that, Ed, is that this other effort of law firm convergence, which is going on here at Tyco, will move large pieces of litigation to alternative fee arrangements. And if you don't mind, let me mention one to you right now. Our convergence process, we're actually doing this by practice area or types of litigation, and we started with product liability litigation. We currently have about 162 law firms retained for X amount of matters in product liability litigation for the U.S. We have now moved that and are in the process of moving it to one law firm, and that's Shook, Hardy, and Bacon. We have negotiated an agreement with Shook, Hardy, which is an alternative fee arrangement. Now, I'll tell you right now that this probably represents about 10 to 15% of what we've been spending right now on litigated matters is in the product liability area. So if we move that to alternative fee arrangement, we're moving a big shift as far as our billings over there. So that's one of the reasons why I say I know that we can kind of move this in big chunks, because we are looking for these converged efforts to lead to alternative fee arrangements. In the case of Shook, Hardy, it's a fixed fee with a holdback and also a bonus associated with it.
Well, Jim, I come out of the food industry quite a few years ago at a time when the food industry, the major supermarkets, were beginning to reduce the number of distributors that went to the back door. And they did it for a number of reasons, one of which was cost savings. And you could really identify what those savings were. How is it that you can identify for yourself as a corporate client what the savings are if you go from 160 or so law firms down to one law firm? What are the metrics there? How do you measure that? And what kind of savings are you talking about?
Well, that's a great question, Ed. It's obviously something that we needed to demonstrate, because it's been a lot of efforts to get to this period. It's been about 6 months to go through the RFP process. Let's start with the first one. The one that most people look at would be the fees and expenses. The negotiated rate that we have agreed to with Shook, Hardy, and Bacon will actually lower our fees and expenses on a fixed fee, even when we include the bonus or holdback, the greatest potential of what that payout could be, that we would reduce against what our forecast was by 36%. So that's a pretty phenomenal number, and we know that we've got cost certainty around that we will do the fees and expenses will be reduced by 36%. In addition, those performance metrics that I talked to you before are ones that we're going to use for the bonus calculation. So if we're able to demonstrate that total case costs go down, cycle time is reduced, exposure levels are reduced, that this is something that Shook, Hardy will be able to go ahead and gain a larger bonus, and it also meets the customer requirements, what our needs are as well. So we feel like we've got a pretty good case to make to say we're starting off already by saying 36% fee and expense reduction. Now, with that in place, let me tell you about the other four or five that we also look that we're going to be able to make a change and for a positive difference. And this doesn't even include the administrative costs that we're going to reduce internally, which we feel is going to be a couple $100,000 as well.
Well, I think you've clearly identified the benefits to the client. I suspect you've identified the benefits to the one law firm that you've selected. What are the benefits to the other law firms that no longer are doing business with you?
Right, and there will be some law firms that may be retained as local counsel, but part of our arrangement with Shook, Hardy is that all local counsel would get billed through this fixed fee arrangement. So that gives us, again, some of the cost certainty. But I think for Shook, Hardy, I truly believe that why we chose them, and we had some very good candidates for this, but they saw that, there would be profitability within the arrangement with Tyco, but looking beyond that. If they're able to work in this model and prove this, and really we both want to prove the same thing, so that our corporate law department, or actually the Tyco law department, can market ourselves that, we did a good thing about convergence and how we did this fee arrangement. But then Shook, Hardy's in that same position, and we will definitely support their efforts and be able to say this was successful. And they're going to be able to appeal to clients like Tyco that are looking for the same changes as far as being able to work as a business model and be able to report on the successes.
Well, Jim, it seems to me that one of the critical elements of alternative billing is that the lawyer has to move away from the concept of attempting to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And the idea that we learned perhaps in law school not to leave any stone unturned for fear that there is something there that will help the client, but I suspect, even more importantly, sort of a CYA issue, that we cannot be accused of not performing well and therefore perhaps being subject to a malpractice action. How do you deal with that in terms of the lawyer's mentality and, I think, legitimate fear that the client will not be happy if something is discovered that could have been discovered had just a little more effort been put into it and a little bit more expense to the client.
And I don't want to say that all answers lead to one thing, but 90% of it has to do with early case assessment. I think a strong early case assessment program, and we've got a protocol for that, and it's going to get bolstered now with the assignment of Shook Hardy on our matters. I think a lot of this goes into what I call level of treatment, and we start off with, let's do the early analysis of the case, come up with what we think our exposure level is and what the value of this case is, and then we assign what I call the level of treatment. And that is, if we were to litigate this, this is what our spend rate would be. These are the steps that we will take on this. And actually maybe we'll go to the next level from larger cases to do a decision tree analysis. And to include the actual business client in that process, I think is very important. So you have both the law firm, in-house counsel, the business client. So it really is an agreed-upon strategy from all. So we're not just letting the law firm say, guess what, take less steps, and that will reduce our costs, and if there's risk associated with it, it's all on you. I think we're really trying to say that this is a unilateral decision that's made by these three different parties, and you've got a tool that can be used to give that confidence for each of those three parties, and that's the early case assessment tool.
One of the things that you mentioned, Jim, was the issue of value to the client, and how is it that the client who may be sophisticated but may not be sophisticated in the legal process, how is it that the client's able to determine value? Or does the system we're talking about, the alternative systems we're talking about, play out only where the buyer of legal services is sophisticated?
Well, it's a great question to ask, and I feel in most cases the client has to maybe define what is value. And this, I'll bring in a little bit of the Six Sigma piece again. One of the areas, again, about Six Sigma is define what's called the voice of the customer and also identify what are the customer requirements. And these are sometimes called critical to quality or critical to cost. And we do that now as far as looking at projects for Six Sigma. And if you look at alternative fee arrangements, engagements with outside counsel, I think you have to start with that. It's to kind of say what is critical to the client's requirements here. Now, my feeling, though, is that if there's a client that's not sophisticated, then the law firm should be in the position to force them in some ways to look at it that way. And the reason I say that is because I think it puts the law firm in a better position to be successful, knowing that they're trying to meet the requirements of the client, and to look beyond just simply, we're just trying to make sure that we don't spend too much on fees and expenses.
Well, I guess to close out our conversation today, I'd like to ask you what you think the future of alternative billing systems, or as one person said, alternative pricing systems rather than billing systems, will be. And what do you see the future for this kind of effort to change our pricing system?
I'd like each one of us, if we could, to answer that question. I'm going to start with Tracy, and then I'd like Joyce, because Joyce is going to be going back for her fourth year at the University of Virginia. I want to give her perspective, and I'll close up on that. Tracy?
I think the future of alternative fee arrangements, I think in the future we're going to move more and more towards asking outside counsel for these alternative pricing arrangements. I don't think we're ever really going to go back to the traditional hourly model, though there are some instances where we will have to. But I think the AFA model is gaining momentum and will continue to do so going forward.
Joyce?
I think it's important that large corporate like Tyco, they set up a model how AFA actually works really well to show the world or to show other corporates that it's working, and to show that, to show to outside counsels, this is the trend that you have to adapt, you have to change along with the way.
That's great. I'm going to just kind of repeat in some ways what Tracy and Joyce just said. I'll add one other piece to this that we didn't talk about. I think we're almost running in dual processes with the alternative fee arrangements. we are going to go ahead with these alternative fee arrangements, still run what I call the run rate. We're using the Timetrics e-billing system right now to say what is the actual fees and expenses that the law firm would be running up, and what is the alternative fee arrangement that we're actually paying on. That gives some comfort level, I think, to both parties that this isn't just some voodoo science and let's just go ahead and put an alternative fee arrangement in place. It really shows for them, here's what the data would be, and then it shows both the client and also to the law firm what it would be with the alternative fee arrangement. Doing that, having the data to support it, along with success stories like Joyce just mentioned, and having leaders in this area such as Jeff Carr with FMC, I think we are going to start seeing the shift over the next 2 to 3 years where over 50%, I would hope, of billings can really move into alternative fee arrangements.
With every interview, major law firm or in-house counsel, Ed hears more particulars on alternative billing methods. Jim Michalowicz has been the most specific of all from his view as litigation program manager at Tyco, with his suggestions of discounts, flat rates, holdbacks, and blended rates. Because the corporation he works for is looking at return on investment, he uses 6 key metrics to measure innovative law firms. Then he corrects defects and variations in the processes with 6 Sigma methodology. Ed's next contributor to this landmark series of interviews on alternative fee billing is Jeff Carr, Vice President, General Counsel, and Secretary of FMC Technologies Incorporated. Ed starts the conversation the same way he has before.
Our topic today is alternative fee arrangements, and in today's world, the preeminent method of billing is really based on the hour, otherwise euphemistically called hourly billing. And historically, I'm not sure that this has been the way that lawyers have always billed for their services. And if not, how did we get to where we are today?
And it's not the way that lawyers have billed traditionally. I think this is something that really kind of came up in probably the 70s or so, if history serves me right. Used to be that bills were given kind of a bottom line for value rendered services and value rendered, and just a dollar figure down there.
Sort of like legal services rendered $5,000?
Exactly. There's a famous story about a Washington lawyer, I think, or might have been a New York lawyer, that sent a bill like that. The client questioned it, and then they sent him back another bill for $25,000, and the $20,000 was to prepare the justification for the first bill.
That sounds like Edward Bennett Williams.
I think it might have been. And this was, I think, driven largely by corporate counsel and insurance counsel in the 70s, maybe the early 80s, when people were frustrated with that kind of billing system. And we kind of went to the billable hour as a way to impose some cost control and as a way to understand the way law firms were billing us. Now, of course, we've got a whole generation of lawyers that know nothing else at this point. I'm in that generation. I mean, I've never worked under any system when I was in private practice other than the billable hour.
Well, there's a lot of dissatisfaction, at least verbalized, with the methodology of hourly billing in recent times. And I guess one of the questions I would ask just as a starting point is there anything right with the system?
Oh, absolutely. Hourly billing is a way to express, it's a rough surrogate for value, time rendered. And if you take time away from a lawyer, that's really the only thing that the lawyer has to give to you. So it's very difficult. If you take an hour from a lawyer, you can't really replace that hour. And that's the way I think a lot of lawyers think these days. And if you use varying billing rates, then you can have a rough approximation of the experience and the type of advice you're getting. You know, if it's $150 an hour for a first-year associate versus $600 an hour for a wizened gray-beard litigator who is absolutely great, then the hourly rate does reflect a qualitative difference as well. It's also easy. I mean, you know, you just add up the time and multiply it.
Well, in terms of value, there's clearly a difference between the, as you say, the wizened gray beard and the new associate. But in terms of value for the client, does a client really care? I mean, the client value, the value to the client is whether they had their objective achieved, isn't it?
That is absolutely right, and that's why there's such a disconnect, I think, with particularly corporate clients and law firms these days. If you think of the law firm model, the economic model is based upon total revenue brought in the door, and that's a function of hourly rate times the number of hours that you actually bill for and can collect for. That has absolutely no relationship whatsoever to the value that the corporate client places on the services. Just as you say, Ed, we want the objective achieved, and we want it achieved in the fastest possible way and in the lowest possible cost. So we've got this disconnect or a divergence of interest here from a law firm model versus what the corporate model wants to pay for. The difficulty is trying to figure out how to reconcile that lack of convergence, if you will.
Well, I guess that leads me to a couple of questions. One is, you're talking about the corporate world, and is this where our new thinking is limited to, as opposed to the individual person or what I call the family kind of matter? And the second question is, if in fact there is this disconnect, why are we still using it, and why is it that so many clients still prefer what we might today call the old way of using the hourly billing?
Sure.
That's a multiple list of questions, I know, but I wanted to make sure I at least got them out on the table for you.
Let me take the last ones first, the old ways question. I think there are a whole lot of reasons for that, but basically I think it's lack of creativity and complacency. Especially in a corporate world, it's just trying to come up with a new way to do it is hard. It's just frankly difficult. And there's also not necessarily a margin in coming up with a new way. You might be able to decrease your costs, but you're taking some risk, especially if you're not using, you know, the premier firm that you may have wanted to use. It takes time. It takes a creative mind, and it takes someone who's looking forward. Now, you got to remember, always, you know, lawyers are all mired in the past. I mean, it's an entire profession based upon things that happened 5 years ago and things that are going to happen 5 years from now. It's very seldomly focused on today. So I think there's a complacency with the way things were done and a lack of creativity to change it. It's also risky to change it. With respect to your first question, the one about, well, is this really just corporate or what do you do about the family person that needs assistance? I think, quite frankly, legal services have gotten too expensive in this country. Look at the rise of things like Nolo Press and Willmaker software packages that essentially permit people to do a lot of what would have been done by a lawyer on their own. Let's face it, most legal work, about 80% of it, in any context, whether it's your personal stuff or whether it's in a corporate world, is kind of commodity-type form practice. It's really that only 20% of high-value, high-risk, bet the company, go to jail, lose your house. Those are the things that you really need the specialized service for. And so I think, in general, legal services have been priced out of the market for the general consumer. You also then have the pure personal injury type work where contingent fees are the rule and the norm, and that just reflects the fact that people are not going to go pay to hire a lawyer to go get them money, but they're willing to give the lawyer a share of the funds if they recover. It's kind of like a lottery, but you know they don't really have skin in the game themselves. I hope I got all your questions in that answer. I'm not sure I did.
I think you did. And what I find particularly interesting, since many of our listeners, as opposed to the readers of this material, will be individual practitioners or small firm practitioners who are dealing in the family context, I think it's important for them to understand that there are alternatives that even they can use.
Absolutely.
The contingency fee that you mentioned in the personal injury case, I think, is a classic example of value billing. I mean, you don't get paid unless you produce a result.
That's right. I personally don't like contingent fees as one of the alternatives to an hourly rate, because I think it's too much of a zero-sum game. You know, I think on the one hand, the lawyer has too much at risk because the recovery is zero, and on the other hand, I think the firm gets enriched if they win. I think there are other alternatives that can be used that better align the disparate interests of both parties, and really gets to the point where what you're trying to do is make the law firm profitable while at the same time achieving whatever the client's interest is. And that's what we try to focus on.
There's a great segue then into this question, which is, what are the alternatives to this hourly system of billing, if not contingency?
Sure, and there are lots of them. I mean, there's the contingent one that we talked about. There are partial contingencies. There are fixed fees. There are project fees. You could use volume-based discounts. That seems to be the most popular, at least in the corporate world, type of a so-called alternative fee. They're caps, in other words, a not to exceed number, or there's some shared risk. If you go over 10% of the budget, as an example, the firm eats that first 10%, and then above a 10% overage, the parties both share some of that overage in some way. And the flip side on the other side, if you're 10% under, the firm gets a bonus, things like that. So there are lots of alternatives to this system. I don't personally like most of the ones that most people talk about. I don't like caps, because then the firm has no incentive to continue to do work, and oftentimes additional work is needed. I don't like, and that's the problem with fixed fees also, and caps are really just fixed fees in disguise, because if you have a cap, you know what you're going to spend. It's going to be the maximum amount that was proposed. And even these ones that have kind of the risk shifting or sharing of overage, that kind of thing, those are good, and those are helpful. What we try to do is we have moved to a performance-based billing model where we're really trying to align our interests with the firm's interests and encourage them to reduce the cost of their providing legal services. Let them focus on making money by reducing their costs, as opposed to billing us for more hours.
So, with all of these alternatives, how do they square with the current rules of professional conduct, such as the ABA Model Rule 1.5, mm-hmm. which require that fees be reasonable? Mm-hmm. I mean, if a lawyer or a law firm can get a bonus, is the fee then still reasonable? I mean, in an answer just a moment ago, you talked about your concern that a firm might be enriched, is the way I think you emphasized it.
Right.
And is that bad if they got the result?
Well, I guess the answer to that is it depends. My personal feeling is giving a law firm 30 to 35 to 40% of a recovery is not reasonable. And at least in the litigation context, there's some studies out there that say, you know, juries are a lot smarter than people think they are. They know that a plaintiff's lawyer is taking about a third away. And so what they do is they gross up the award that they want to give to the plaintiff. What that's doing is that's just a massive wealth shift. It's in order to compensate the plaintiffs for the value that a jury thinks it should exceed, they just add a third on top of it, so that the lawyer gets paid, because what they're interested in is making sure the plaintiff gets compensated. That's an incredible cost on society. There's some studies out there today that say that the mass tort industry and just the personal injury industry in the United States puts a tax on the economy of up to 2% of the GDP. And that's a total of defense costs and recoveries and plaintiff costs, but that's an incredible amount of money.
It is, but would those cases be handled if the benefit were not out there? In the sense that, for example, in your mass torts cases, there's an incredible amount of investment that has to be made to get the case to trial, first of all, and then to get the jury to see the wisdom of it.
Sure, I agree with that. There certainly is. Unfortunately, though, most cases never go to trial. And it's essentially a form of legalized extortion. You look at a company like Halliburton that thought that its individuals or that its activities had not harmed individuals and had brought some asbestos cases against them. They lost, you know, I think the number was about two-thirds of their market cap overnight after a couple of jury verdicts against them. And these were cases where, as I understand it, there was only a fear of prospective injury, not a not an actual manifestation of harm. That's a pretty amazing vignette, I think, in the system. You know, it's this classic debate that goes on in the United States of the difference between the English rule, where the loser pays, and our system, where you've got contingent-based litigation. I'm not sure which is the right one. I personally favor the English rule because I think people should, if they've got good cases, they should bring them, and they're going to get compensated for them, and their legal fees are going to be paid. The flip side is contingent fee arrangements do permit plaintiffs who cannot afford litigation to litigate,